The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator. Hello and welcome to the Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and Paul Staines from the Guido Fawkes blog. So after Matt Hancock's bombshell revelation of his affair, we wanted to ask how much of politicians' private lives, in particular their sex lives, are actually in the public interest and why do we care? Fraser, maybe to start with, you can give us your first reaction when you heard about Friday's news.
Right, well, I got an email from James Forsyth at, I think, 5:40 in the morning.
Is that when you guys normally email each other?
Well, both James and I have kids, so we have to get up early in the morning, and we sort of liaise quite often. And I have to confess, my first instinct was, okay, if Matt Hancock's had an affair, then I don't really see why we should touch the story. People's relationships go in funny kind of ways, and I don't want to intrude on private grief. Because James emailed me saying, what should we do about the Matt Hancock affair? He didn't really say the circumstances. That's my first reaction. Then I looked into it and found out she's on the staff. Then you find out that there's this clinch that was taken in defiance of the regulations he put down already. And then I thought that this actually does matter, because I was always very concerned that the government has put into law the social distancing guidelines. Not that hasn't really affected my life, but that there are so many young people who were literally banned by the government from holding hands with their boyfriend or girlfriend, from kissing, from spending the night if you didn't live together. And I couldn't believe, actually, that these laws were passed without more uproar, because everybody's life and circumstance is different. You can get people who are very close but aren't cohabiting, for example. Why should they be separated by law? So when you find a government minister who is violating the laws which he himself wanted to put into law, then that does put a different perspective on it. We once had a piece we ran in The Spectator a few months ago by somebody saying he hadn't kissed his girlfriend during lockdown. And, you know, you might think that's a bit extreme, but there are lots of people who did actually take these laws very seriously and who will be absolutely hopping mad to find out that the people who literally wrote them, and Matt Hancock himself was giving us guidance on how to hug and how not to hug, when you think about it, bizarre for government to do that, was himself breaking those laws. So that's why I think what, in one way, is a personal, I wouldn't say tragedy, but it is his personal business. But it does become political if it demonstrates them making one law and governing by another. And it's funny that Dominic Cummings has been saying all sorts of things about Matt Hancock in the last few weeks. Terrible things that, you know, Matt Hancock sent people from hospitals to seed the virus into care homes. I don't think that will have much impact as this. Mm. Certainly going around the office yesterday, many of our colleagues, and, you know, you and I are into politics, not everybody else is, but those who weren't picked up this in the peripheral vision and were hopping mad. Mm. So I think this is an example of a personal misdemeanour that does have political salience precisely because of the regime which Matt Hancock and his ministers, the legal regime, have put everybody else under for quite some time.
Paul, what was your first reaction? Are you hopping mad? Or do you know anyone who is hopping mad?
I laughed. I enjoy all these scandals and I can't hide it. You might say, for self-interested reasons, when you run a political gossip website, I've always taken the view, it's kind of an old-fashioned view, that people in public life who cheat on their wives are more likely to lie to the voters if they'll lie to the person closest to them. Now, this has caused me many, many arguments. Michael Portillo, I remember having quite a big go at me on The Moral Maze, which is on BBC Radio 4, about this. You might say it's self-interest, but there is some truth in it. You look at the people who have cheated on their wives, they tended to be not the straightest of politicians either.
They go quite high up, don't they, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, Clinton goes quite high up. I'm watching, because I don't want to reveal any affairs that I think are going on, so I'm watching my words a bit more carefully than usual. Interestingly, if you look back, I look back at what we wrote about Gina, the mistress, and what other people have written about Gina as well. And the phrase close friends came up quite often in all our publications, I think. So whether there was a hint that perhaps we might have known this was going on.
Is that, you think that's a euphemism for there might be a bit more than close friends?
Exactly. I think it's been actionable close friends before.
Well, I guess if it becomes an acknowledged euphemism, then, you know, the test is what an average reader would take it to mean. But let's take, you know, when Greg Barker left his wife for his male decorator, that was not a story. That was basically, you know, that was a complication in his life. And perhaps if that had happened 30 years ago, it might have hit the tabloids. But right now, I'm not even sure it was much of a story. So, I mean, over the years, the criteria for these things has, for public interest threshold, has gone up quite a lot. When Robin Cook, for example, was found to be having an affair with one of his staffers, Alistair Campbell, who was then Tony Blair's press chief, called him up basically and said, right, I want you to get clarity on your personal situation. So to have an affair with a staffer was then quite an important thing, which George Osborne, of course, he had an affair with Thea Rogers. That was when he was, well, he's no longer married to his first wife, Frances, and he's now together with Thea.
Is he?
Well, is he not?
Is he? I don't think it's, I think they're having a difficult stage in their relationship.
Shall we move on? It sounds like there are a few different types of sex scandals we're talking about here. We're talking about cheating while you're married. We're talking about maybe potential abuse of power when someone you're having sex with is younger than you, working with you. And you mentioned Greg Barker, so there's, perhaps it's a certain level of sexuality.
It's interesting you mentioned abuse of power, because I'm not sure. That might be how it's seen now. It wouldn't necessarily be seen how it was 25, 30 years ago. But you're certainly right now. The sort of scandals we get is, here's an MP sending suggestive messages to somebody junior, and it's now implicit that this is an abuse of power. So we've had, what resignations have we had?
Well, Rob Roberts.
Rob Roberts got a lot of trouble, and I thought that, even though we were pushing that story quite hard, I thought that was at the lower end of the offence threshold.
He'd been sexting.
He'd tried it on, and, you know, I know it was acceptable in the 80s, but I mean, I got my face slapped a few times in the 80s, and, you know, things that were acceptable then aren't acceptable now. And I'm now very, very careful. And a woman who left me, my employee, said, you never looked down below my headline. Because I'm terrified. I don't even know what's allowed or not allowed, you know. So I'm very careful. Sorry, going back to, I thought the example of Cook was a very relevant example, because that was a staffer. The office politics, never mind now that everyone knows there's a CCTV camera in the corner of the office. The office politics now, I don't think she can stay in his employ, because even in a normal corporate environment, you can't. Yeah. You have to declare, did he tell the permanent secretary? I doubt it.
What about their... Well, by the way, that's assuming it's a proper relationship. They might have just had a passionate moment in the corridor.
I admire your naivety, though. I admire that. Given we are in the Spectator editor's office...
And which Boris Johnson's sofa in front of us.
If there was a CCTV camera in here, oh, the tales that could be told.
Yeah, the furniture alone, but...
Paul, can I pick you up on your first point, which is that you actually do think, if I understand you correctly, that it is a public interest for a politician to lie about their marriage, because you think that they would lie about politics too.
They are giving a false prospectus to the public, for a start, that, you know, I know it's unfashionable now, but, you know, conservative values, family, all those kind of things, when you're chasing the office boys or girls around the, you know,
Fraser, what do you make of that? I mean, Paul seems to say is that if you're cheating at all, it's a public interest story.
I wouldn't say that at the moment. And also, I think right now, public interest defence is quite serious business if you're in journalism. For example, you know, with the News of the World, where I had a column for a while, they got stories the whole time, and they had to disregard so many of them because they couldn't prove it was definitely in the public interest.
Certainly, I mean, I've been in this game now 18 years, and certainly post-Leveson, the difficulty of getting a pants-down story into a newspaper, there has to be another reason. They simply won't be accepted. I've spoken to many editors about this, and breaking your vows to your wife is not enough. Mm. Or your husband, sorry. So this one does have the angle that the rules. He set the rules.
Yeah.
And I think that makes it very difficult. I can't see them both being in the same position next week.
I guess famously, the News of the World was sued by Max Mosley because it did a front page thing about how he'd organised hookers and had an orgy in the dungeon. And I think the detail which they wrote, which you just disputed was that it had this sort of Nazi theme
yes,
to it.
Right.
Now, Max Mosley's dad, of course, was a notorious British far-righter. Now, his suggestion was that the News of the World invented this detail to make out that it had a wider public interest than just a period, here's a Formula One boss, look what he gets up to in his own spare time. But that was certainly, as far as the law is concerned, if you're going to write about anybody having an affair with anybody else, then you need to explain why that is in the public interest. And a lot of these things just, you know, that simply aren't. And then, of course, you've got the kiss and tells aren't so easy now, because you've had kiss and tells over the... They've almost died out, actually, as a genre. You've got, for example, Helen Wood, who is a retired prostitute who wrote a diary for The Spectator, a very good diary.
I think we have to say sex worker now.
Do we? Well, that's not how she describes herself anyway. But, you know, she's a very intelligent, thoughtful woman. But her story was not accepted because of a super injunction of the person who she had a liaison with. So she is not allowed to tell her story under the current law. And, of course, you had David Meller, famously. He had an affair with a prostitute and she went to The Sun. And she, I think, from memory, that was a Chelsea strip, wasn't it, Paul?
It was a Chelsea strip. You know, there's always... in these scandals, quite often a totemic item in it, and whether it's a Nazi get-up or a Chelsea strip, because
like
that's what makes it different from every other.
But it got him on the board of Chelsea, ultimately, didn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
So it's quite good for him in the end. But there's always has to be a detail, and at the time, it was imagined that the now-dead Max Clifford had invented that detail and given it to her to make it that much spicier for the newspaper. But that kind of manoeuvre, you just simply don't get that nowadays because of the public interest defence. But here, of course, you'd met Hancock in a photograph, so the camera doesn't lie. I'd love to know how that photograph found its way to the newspaper.
A lot of kickback from friends at The Sun that there's any security angle on this and that they got it from the FSB or anything like that. So there are a couple of different theories. One, amusingly, is that, and I haven't got any confirmation from The Sun before I go any further on that, that the external contractors who run the security somehow had access to it.
Right.
Because bear in mind, you can't pay a civil servant for a story.
That's implying it was sold, which it needn't be. I mean, somebody might have got annoyed with Matt Hancock's social distancing regime and thought the public needed to know what was going on in the corridors of the Department of Health.
The description of them as whistleblowers suggests that it was a noble and important piece of information the public should know.
Paul, you say that you can't imagine either of them being in the same positions they are next week. Do you think that Matt Hancock is also at risk?
I don't think the boss is going to fire him. Not for this.
If Boris starts firing people for misdemeanors in their private
tricky,
life...
Tricky, slippery slope, then.
That's not going to happen. But I just think the difficulties of the office atmosphere, it would be impossible. You know, the decision-making processes, and if you're her work colleague, it's not going to feel like it's going to be a fair office, is it? So
I don't think she'll ever show up for work there ever again. I'd be surprised if she does. But Matt Hancock seems to be quite confident. Apparently he's told colleagues that he won't be sacked.
Because he apologised, so maybe he is...
He apologised for breaking
so
social distancing, etc. In my view, he should apologise for the whole regime and putting it under law rather than making a guidance and time to reflect on that. But overall, if you look at you see these stories... I mean, in Scotland, you get them all the time, by the way, these stories. The SNP... are the romantic mujahideen of these things, the things which they get up to up there. I mean, some of them are romantic, some of them are far less romantic, and in Alex Salmond's case, a borderline criminal. But in the House of Commons has actually been quite calm by its old standards recently. You've had, you know, the sexting, and Stephen Crabbe had to resign, didn't he, as well, for sending a similar message. You had Brooks Newmark, who was then a minister, and what was it? It was your colleague Alex Wickham, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, we came up with the idea of, we had a few, we were a bit bored, and we had a few MPs we knew were at it, shall we say.
At what?
At things. Things, on can't say on a family podcast. So we decided to encourage them, shall we say. And we thought this would be a long-term project and would take some time. And 24 hours later, Brooks Newmark is sending pictures of his penis to us.
Right. So, and by the way, the project, just for those who haven't heard it, you basically, Alex Wickham, who now writes the Politico Daily Email, posed as a girl with a girl's picture and basically was texting online.
But he didn't dress up as a girl.
He got some library picture of
exactly.
A girl. And said, please send us a picture of your private parts. And Brooks Newmark did so.
Within 24
hours. No, that's not exactly the order of play. It's very important that, because the negotiations with the newspaper that we actually shared the story with, The Mirror, and The Sun turned it down because they thought it was entrapment? Had we made the first move. Brooks Newmark definitely made the first move. That was the whole thing.
Right.
He was the one who requested the pictures. This all progressed a lot faster than we expected.
Okay.
We didn't expect Ministers of the Crown to be going to that stage that fast with someone they'd never met.
Well, I guess this confirms your theory, but it's funny that we got a letter from Brooks Newmark's lawyers recently demanding that we take down the picture which he sent to, there was never any picture of his honourable member, as it were, but there was a picture
of... There was no pictures that we shared.
Shared, yeah, exactly. But there was a picture of him in his paisley patterned pyjamas, and it turns out he's now bought that picture, he's got the copyright to it, so he can now demand that we take it down. We're saying, look, we're just sharing the front page of a newspaper. No, we had to take that down as well. I wasn't aware that's something you could do. If it's an embarrassing picture of yourself, you buy it.
I can't remember exactly the terms of the contract, but I don't think I gave eternal ownership of it to News UK. So, bad luck, Brooks. Yeah. I don't think you do own it.
Well, it's certainly, I remember at the Tory party conference a few months later, they were selling these paisley pattern pajamas and they were going down quite well amongst the members, so Brooks Newmark could be a fashion... But the thing is, given that this was your sting, as it were, Paul, where was the public interest in that?
He was a Minister of the Crown and exposing himself to the risk of blackmail to strangers. That could have been a Russian honey trap, couldn't it? Rather than a SW1-sourced honey trap. So, very important. What was his important position? I can't remember. Minister for Paperclips.
Wasn't it? I don't know. It was Minister for Social Care or something like that. I can't remember. And you had Keith Vaz. Do you remember Keith Vaz and the Rent Boy?
Keith Vaz, yes. That was amusing. I mean, there was drugs involved in that.
That
so
was the
law breaking.
Because it wasn't so much that he'd been using a Rent Boy. It was that he'd offered to pay for the Rent Boy's drugs. I think that was the criminality. If you've got an example of a politician breaking the law or being complicit in illegality, that's what makes it public interest, and that's what's got a political dimension. Although I'm not quite sure. I mean, would you say this has hurt Stephen Crabbe's career?
Well, Stephen Crabbe, didn't Theresa May say, is there anything else, before she was going to bring him back? And he went, And he didn't get the promotion. So I'd say it has quite blunted his career.
I suppose remember he ran for leader with Ajit Javid? There's a joint ticket or something peculiar like that. We haven't heard much from him or from Brooks Newmark, who's now apparently lecturing people in Oxford. And Keith Vaz was a backbencher. So I'm not sure how much sex scandal will actually... Well, by the way, let's look at the Prime Minister himself, right? Now, it wasn't so long ago where you would not have been able to conceive of, for example, a Prime Minister who, doesn't say on the record how many children he has, for example, getting to the highest. Now, and I think the country is tolerant of that. Nobody really minds that much. There is no sort of Victorian morality rule. But I think that Boris Johnson is not remotely hypocritical about this, and I think that's what matters. It wasn't that when John Major got into such trouble because he spoke about family values, and then that led to all sorts of... I think Tim Yeo, one of his ministers, was complaining about broken families, and he himself had fathered a love child. So, the moment you start to preach morality, you become vulnerable to charges of hypocrisy. I'm not sure anybody could call Boris Johnson hypocritical. And he's had a family history and family structure, shall we say, which have not been conventional by prime ministerial standards. But as far as I can work out, people genuinely don't mind.
But does Boris Johnson hold a sort of exceptional place in this? Because Jennifer R. Curie's case, for example, never really blew up in his face either, and arguably there was public interest in that because he did take her on some of his trips.
I think the time had passed, it was a few years ago, we all sort of knew the story. I know Labour honed in on the financial aspect of it, but they never really made it hit home. So you're arguably that could have been a lot worse for...
Do you think the public are in a different place to the three of us, the punditry, the Westminster Village on this? Do you think that, I don't know, I mean, either they think that we should care more about it or that we should care less about it?
Well, famously to that phrase, isn't there? The public might be interested, but is it in the public interest? And I've got no doubt that this story, as Fraser said earlier, has massive cut through. Off people who aren't on Twitter, Instagram is abuzz now with memes of Matt Hancock. So I think people, this will run. I noticed that it was quite a short story, which suggests to me that perhaps there's more to come.
Really?
More pictures? I don't know. But I would have thought they've got the video, right? So they've only released really one picture.
They've certainly seen the video. Because
they've certainly seen the
video. Matt Hancock's
they've taken
behavior
a screenshot
before
of it or somehow. So I wonder if there's more legs on this.
And finally, for listeners who've got this far in this sordid episode of Coffee House Shots, I wondered, Paul and Fraser, your opinions on how Westminster specific are these problems of sex scandals. Is Westminster a particularly archaic working environment? You hear parliamentary researchers complaining about certain MPs that they wouldn't want to work for, or is it just that it happens everywhere and that they're in the public eye?
Oh, the entertainment industry's just had a big scandal. The tech world, even Bill Gates is at it, right? So all the tech bros, apparently it's a toxic masculine environment. I think human nature is human nature in most industries.
And the strange thing, of course, is this the slight power dynamic. And an MP friend of mine, who's a single man, he said that there's a sort of law. If you're basically a 3 in the real world, you're an 8 in Westminster. Because there's a sort of magnifier then. So people, you know, would be able to you know, attract women they might not otherwise be able to attract. Politics has got a slightly strange magnifier there. And you know, you can argue, and it was argued for a while, that it's because it's an unhealthy atmosphere, they're all drinking in the same places, they're all cooped up together, and any bunch of humans, if put in this pressure oven and not really allowed to go out, you're going to get some strange and dysfunctional things going on. But then again, if you look at, as I was saying earlier, the Scottish Parliament, I think, can put to shame anything happening in Westminster. We don't do these late night sittings anymore. But I think during, I mean, this is why my first instinct was sympathy towards Matt Hancock, because so many people have been under so much pressure recently that you can see under strange circumstances, things, your personal family balance might fall apart. But I think political scandals just simply are exposed more because of, there is a public interest. We do want to think that if politicians are sending the police after us if we're sitting next to a park bench, then they themselves are abiding by the rules they set for the rest of us. And I think that's one of the rules of journalism, actually, is to make sure these politicians know that there are eyes on them. So if they do intend to say one thing and do another, they ought to, in a democracy, be a little bit fearful that somebody like Paul and Guido Fawkes' website is going to be on their case. The Spectator, by the way, can I say, for all of our supply of scandal, we tend not to, you know, break many of those stories, but with one great exception, Kate Andrews in this week's magazine has got a fantastic rendition of all the ways in which ministers have been saying one thing and doing another throughout the pandemic. So I think there's a long kind of, I guess, free press democratic tradition of being interested in these things. The legal definition of public interest might change, but as the government passes more and more laws over what was previously our private lives, I think ministers can, unfortunately for them, expect this kind of scrutiny.
Paul, would you like a final word?
One suspicion I have is that because of modern mores, more MPs are having affairs with other MPs than their staff.
Right, because it's more balanced in terms of power.
The risk is the same for both of the sides of the transaction, right?
Yeah, and also,
and they won't be in trouble for, you know, abuse of power.
And also, as one former cabinet member said to me, never have an affair with somebody who's got less to lose than you have. That's one of the codes for keeping it secret. And there is a lot going on. We had one of our interns recently in the office came over, and he was all cock-a-hoop because he'd found this great scoop that, I shan't name them, the one MP was having an affair with another one. And he's, oh, great, we can run this. And we say, well, first of all, not really. You need proof. Secondly, is it in the public interest? These are two sort of single MPs are entitled to do what they want. It's just not like it used to be. And I think it's funny because the intern, he couldn't quite work it out. He thought, but surely that's what journalism is. You just write rumours. No, there's actually quite a high threshold to pass now. And as Paul says, MPs can get with other MPs. And journalists have a pretty hard time explaining how revealing that relationship would be in the public interest.
Paul Staines and Fraser Nelson, thank you very much.